Welcome to the Original Jurisdiction Podcast. I'm your host, David Latt, author of a Substack newsletter about law and the legal profession, also named Original Jurisdiction, which you can read and subscribe to at davidlatt.substack.com. You're listening to the 42nd episode of this podcast, recorded on Saturday, March 23. Thanks to this podcast's sponsor, NextFirm. NextFirm helps big law attorneys become founding partners. To learn more about how NextFirm can help you launch your firm, call 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com. Want to know who the guest will be for the next Original Jurisdiction podcast? Follow NextFirm on LinkedIn for a preview. Those of you who follow the world of Supreme Court litigation know how rare it is to have multiple SCOTUS arguments in a single term. It's a distinction that can be claimed by a few of my past podcast guests, like Lisa Blatt, Paul Clement, and Neil Katyal, but it's very, very unusual. Here's something that's even more unusual. Having your first Supreme Court argument in October, and then having two more arguments before the justices in the very same term. It sounds pretty impossible to achieve, but Isha Anand just proved it can be done, which is why I had to have her on the podcast. Isha currently serves as co-director of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic at Stanford Law School. Prior to joining the SLS faculty in 2023, she was an appellate and Supreme Court litigator at the MacArthur Justice Center and ORIC, and before those roles, she served as a law clerk to Judge Paul Watford of the Ninth Circuit and Justice Sonia Sotomayor of the Supreme Court. In February, Isha won a unanimous victory in the case she had her first argument in, Murray v. UBS Securities. She's waiting for a ruling in the second case she argued, Campos Chavez v. Garland. And later this month, she'll return to 1 First Street to argue Chiaverini v. City of Napoleon. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Isha Anand. Isha, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I was just talking to my husband and telling him how excited I am to be on this podcast, given the star caliber of your recent guests.
Well, we're excited to have you just because you really are a new star on the scene, and we'll get to that in just a second. But I always like to begin at the beginning. Tell me about where you grew up.
Sure. So I grew up partly in India. So I lived in a city that was then called Bombay. And I moved to the U.S. when I was around 9 years old, so middle of elementary school. And I did the rest of elementary school, middle and high school, just outside of Washington, D.C. in Rockville, Maryland, kind of end of the red line. And as you can imagine, sort of a tough age to move, to have a thick accent, to have learned a very British form of English. And so it took a couple of years for me to stop feeling nostalgic for my time in India, but eventually acclimated and now think of Rockville as home.
And were there any early hints that you might become a lawyer?
It's funny, when you said you were going to ask me this question, I texted my mother, who claims that my fifth grade teacher told her that I would become a lawyer, which I don't, which doesn't sound particularly flattering. Like, you can imagine what kind of fifth grader a teacher would say is going to be a lawyer someday. But other than that, no, you know, I didn't do sort of speech and debate when I was in high school. I thought of myself as probably annoyingly passionate advocate in various ways. I had a lot of causes I cared deeply about, but not in a way that made me think that, oh, being a lawyer is the way that I'm going to work on these issues. In fact, for a long time, I thought that the way I was going to work on those issues was sort of as a journalist. My heroes were all sort of muckrakers and people who brought atrocities to light in various ways. And I thought that was going to be my role.
So were you a journalist in either high school or when you were at Yale?
Yes. So I was the editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper. That was a big part of my identity for a long time. I worked on the newspaper in college. And after college, I spent some time at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, which was this sort of fabulous daily in probably one of the most fun cities in the world to be a journalist. It's lively, to say the least. And then at the Wall Street Journal, where I was sort of covering politics in the DC bureau. And I was there during kind of election season 2008, which meant that all the real grown-up journalists were off on like the McCain and Obama campaign planes. And I got to cover all kinds of other things. I got to cover governor's races and all kinds of down ballot things that in a normal year, they never would have given to such a baby reporter.
So you actually started off with a great career in journalism. A lot of journalists have to start at some really obscure paper and then work their way up. But you already started at one of the nation's great papers. And then you moved to one of the top papers. So why would you give up such a great career at journalism? You were at the Wall Street Journal. A lot of people want to end their careers at the Wall Street Journal. And for you, it was just the beginning. How'd you make the shift to law?
Well, so this is where the kind of happenstance and bad luck of the draw kind of comes in. So my partner was starting a graduate program out in California. So we were moving to the Bay Area and I was job hunting. And I was job hunting kind of in the sort of tail end of the Great Recession. I guess the 2008 Great Recession. We've had a few since then, but the 2008 Great Recession. And it was a time of real crunch for a lot of people. For newspapers in particular, it was a time when they were sort of trying to figure out a new model. As a former journalist yourself, you're sort of on the front end of this, but they're trying to figure out, like, how do we make money off the internet? So newspapers weren't hiring, newspapers were downsizing. And so when I moved out to the Bay Area, the job I eventually got was as an investigator. So I joined an outfit doing capital defense work, and I was going to be an investigator. And I sort of thought to myself at the time, this involves a lot of writing. This involves a lot of similar skills to journalism, right? Cold calling people, knocking on their doors, trying to get them to talk to you, digging up records, piecing together a story, all of that. That's all stuff that journalists do. And so I'll do this job. And then when a job opens up at a newspaper, I can sort of pitch this as a relevant resume reply and then get back into journalism where I belong. And of course, that's not what happened. But that was the sort of veer that my career took, was just, frankly, I couldn't find a job in the profession I wanted to pursue.
So did working as an investigator on these capital cases where people's lives were on the line cause you to just become fascinated by the law? Was that what drew you in?
So it's funny, looking back now, it's hard to say how that led to this because, first of all, I was working for a lot of lawyers who all kind of hated law school. Second of all, at the time, I didn't fully understand the sort of odds against which we were working. So I didn't know what habeas was, right? I was doing mostly habeas work. I didn't know what habeas was. I didn't understand quite how long the odds were. And so I was sort of in this ignorant little bubble where I sort of thought, if I piece together a compelling story of innocence, if I piece together this compelling story of mitigation, right? So for many of my clients, the question wasn't guilt or innocence. It was death versus life without parole. And they'd had these horrific upbringings, right? Just generations on generations of trauma and poverty and mental illness and abuse of every kind you can imagine. And so I sort of thought, oh, well, our job is we're going to put together the story and a decision maker will see it. And of course, we'll resentence our client or we'll let them out of prison. And it wasn't until years later when I was halfway through law school and took a class on post-conviction work that I realized, like, oh no, that's not even the start of the story. So it's funny that that experience led me to law school, given that actually what I was seeing, even though I didn't really recognize it at the time, was the ways in which the law wasn't necessarily going to map onto what I thought the law should be. But frankly, I got a little older. I got a little bit burnt out. I was on the road constantly. I'd be interviewing a witness in Idaho and then one in Western Massachusetts, and then I'd be in Arizona. And I sort of thought, I want to do something that feels a little bit more stable, where I have a little more control over my time. And even though that job was life-affirming in ways I couldn't have foreseen going into it, and I learned more probably from that job than any other I've had since, I just felt like I wanted a job that felt a little bit more like what I thought of in my head as a grown-up job. And so I took the LSAT, applied to law school, was lucky enough to get into Berkeley, which is where my partner was doing graduate school, and felt like, all right, I guess this is the next step. This is the step to go from this job that I care about so much to maybe a version of this that looks a little bit more stable.
So at the time you went into your first clerkship, did you have a clear sense of what you wanted your post-clerkship legal career to look like?
So not at all. And to the extent I did, it was actually very different from what I wound up doing. So going into my first clerkship, I assumed I would do something related to criminal justice. And I actually assumed that I would be a trial level lawyer of some kind, because I'd had this experience and I sort of thought, look, my skill set is finding the relevant records, talking to people and getting to figure out their story. Like, that's my skill set, is putting together the story in the first place. And so even though I signed up to do this appellate clerkship, I sort of thought of myself as doing it because I clerked for Judge Watford and he was just an extraordinary human being. And I sort of thought, well, whatever I want to do with my life, learning from someone who's this brilliant and has this really deep commitment to the rule of law in a way that's sort of not naive, but just really genuine, it can't hurt to get to spend a year under this person's tutelage. So at the time, I sort of thought this was a little bit of a digression. I'm going to do some appellate law for a year, and then I'm going to come back and do this skill I thought I had, and that'll be that. And so that was what I was thinking coming into my first clerkship.
That's so interesting. And I have to say, I share your admiration for Judge Watford. It really is such a loss for the bench that he departed. I totally get it. And I actually really admire the statement he made when he departed, basically saying that, look, I understand my duties as a judge. And if they aren't consistent with, in some respects, my views of justice on certain issues, then maybe I should do something else. I really respect that because I think there's some judges who will twist the law. And I respected him for saying, you know what, I don't feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And my priors may be very different from his in terms of the role of judges and the role of lawyers and the role of the legal system. But it was so important for me to have at a formative point in my career, just someone I could work with who really felt it, as you're describing, that his role was something very specific. It was to apply the law to the best of his understanding, free of any ideological priors. And, you know, I think I had sort of come through law school and had the sense of like, oh, that's just naive, right? I had this very legal realist view of the law. And I sort of felt like no one does that. There's no, you know, calling balls and strikes. None of that makes any sense. And so to get to spend a year with someone who genuinely believed in that vision of the law, not from a place of Judge Watford is as familiar as anyone with the ways in which the legal system is grotesquely unfair, but from a really considered place, I think that was really, really important to me and really influential in the way I saw the law going forward.
That must have been a great learning experience. And then I'm sure so was your next clerkship. You said you weren't sure you wanted to go into appellate work, and then you went to the biggest appellate court of all.
So that's right. So again, it was about the specific person. So I had the opportunity to clerk for Justice Sotomayor, who was a hero of mine, right? I mean, for so many of us who didn't see a ton of people who looked like us in various ways in positions of power, she was just this truly remarkable human being. I felt like the day I got the interview with her was the luckiest day of my life. And I kind of walked in feeling like, I don't know what's going to happen from this, but getting to spend 30 minutes one-on-one with Justice Sotomayor, like, they can't get any better than this. And then I got the clerkship and I learned so much from that experience. Justice Sotomayor is such a remarkable human being and jurist, and she treats her clerks like family. She officiated my wedding.
Wow.
She was okay. One of the first people to meet my son when he got out of the NICU. He was born really prematurely and spent some time in the hospital. And one of the first people to meet him when he got out was Justice Sotomayor. And so she taught me a huge amount about not just sort of professionally, right? So she taught me some things like, how do you write to make change, not just writing to other lawyers? How do you think about where to put your political capital when you have so many issues that you care about? Mm-hmm. How do you think critically and package arguments into a frame that's acceptable for other people on the bench and other lawyers, but also not lose sight of what's really happening in the real world? I think that those are all things that law school doesn't necessarily teach you, but she taught me. And then she also taught me about what our kind of obligations are to the people in our life. And despite her position of extraordinary power and extraordinary influence, she's always the person who is there for a friend or there for a colleague or there for her clerks. And I sort of learned from her, I think it's easy for lawyers, particularly busy lawyers, to think our career is an excuse for not being the kind of human being we want to be in all facets of our lives. I certainly face that temptation, and seeing her be just the best sister and daughter and friend and mentor, despite everything she had going on, made me realize that, no, that's all it is. It's an excuse.
Mm-hmm. I have so much admiration for her. And you can tell she's somebody remarkable just by being in her presence. I've had the honor of meeting her, and she just has a kind of energy and a positivity. And I can see why she's an icon for so many young people. And she's written children's books. So that must have been an amazing experience.
It was. And we are huge fans of our children's books. She was kind enough to feature my son in one of her children's books.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. So if you read Just Help, there's a character called Kunal, who's modeled after my son. She put a lot of her grand clerks in her children's books in various capacities.
My gosh,
so
I
that is
that.
His favorite book of all time. And he gets uncontrollably excited when we get to that page of the book.
Oh my gosh, I love that. So before we return in some ways to the Supreme Court, but I guess as advocate rather than clerk, looking back over your legal career so far, and you still have so many exciting years ahead, what would you say is the case or matter that you're most proud of?
There are a lot, and a lot of them are cases or matters that don't make for particularly good stories, because the story is we fought really hard and either won or lost, but I can talk about two that were particularly meaningful for me. One is a story where the courts did the right thing, but it still had a sad ending. And one is a story where courts did the wrong thing, but it still had a happy ending. So the first one I want to talk about is a case I did on behalf of the Timpa family. So Tony Timpa was someone who was killed by Dallas police. They kneeled on his back for 14 minutes while he was handcuffed and he asphyxiated. So I represented his family in an appeal to the Fifth Circuit after the district court had granted police officers qualified immunity. And the reason that I think of this as a story that's really meaningful to me is I came into this feeling like, I don't know, I'm going to the Fifth Circuit. What are they going to do? The Fifth Circuit doesn't care about people like this. And I drew a conservative panel. Two of the judges in the panel, Judge Clement and Judge Willett, were Republican appointees. And yet, I and the team of fellows at the MacArthur Justice Center had really scorched the earth with this case. We knew the record forward and backward. We'd pulled out every tidbit possible. A trial attorney had built this amazing record, not just about what happened in this case, but just about how widely known it was, right? For decades before this happened, how widely known it was that you don't kneel on the back of someone who's face down. That is incredibly dangerous. We had evidence that police officers had been trained on this. We had evidence that there'd been report after report on this, that basically every police officer knew this rule. And we had amicus briefs from folks who had studied policing, sort of reinforcing that. I still went in being skeptical. I sort of thought, oh, the Fifth Circuit, that's where, you know, civil rights go to die. And we won, right? And Judge Clement, sort of not someone I think of as a sort of liberal lion, wrote this incredibly sort of robust, compassionate, detailed opinion explaining exactly why these officers were not entitled to qualified immunity. And that shouldn't have been a surprise to me, but it was. And I think it's a story that was really meaningful to me because it reminds me that actually, I think it's easy to feel if you have a certain set of political priors, like, oh, the courts are hopeless. And I don't mean to sugarcoat or gloss over the ways in which some of the decisions that come down are ones I deeply disagree with that I think are wrong and not a fair view of the law. So I don't mean to gloss over that. I think that people who highlight that are doing really important work. But I just want to highlight for people who see that as a sort of a reason to give up, that not always, right? That judges, I think most judges still want to do the right thing under the law, that there are still opportunities where really good lawyering makes a difference. And when you're right, I think that sometimes you're just right. And even judges who may deeply disagree with the outcome or who may have ruled in other cases in ways that you deeply disagree with can see that. The story's still ongoing. There hasn't been a happy ending yet. And the first jury trial ended in a sort of split verdict that was disappointing for the family. But that's one of the cases that I'm the most proud of because it was a case that sort of surprised me. The other case is a case where I felt like some courts did the wrong thing. So this is a case where I represented a man named Riley Bruinus, who had been convicted of a crime he committed when he was 17. He drove the getaway car in a sort of robbery gone wrong where a subway clerk was tragically killed and he was sentenced to life. While behind bars, he grew up, right? He was a kid when this happened. While behind bars, he grew up. He became deeply religious. He became a mentor in a kind of Bible study group to other men in the prison. We talked to person after person, correctional officers, fellow inmates, about how Mr. Bruinus was the person that kept them clean when they were tempted to go back to using, who gave them the strength to leave their prison gang, who was sort of the person that the guards trusted with all sorts of responsibilities. And he'd become just this kind of remarkable human being. And he'd done this even though he was serving a life sentence with no possibility of parole, right? So it couldn't have been transactional. He genuinely had grown up in the way that I think a lot of people convicted as teenagers do. So at the time, the kind of governing law of the land was a case called Montgomery versus Louisiana, in which Justice Kennedy at the time had written that the Eighth Amendment had kind of restrictions on when you can impose life without parole on a juvenile offender. And so adhering to that precedent, the Ninth Circuit sitting en banc, and this is actually the very first case I ever argued was before the en banc Ninth Circuit, said he gets a resentencing. So amazing news. He's celebrating, his wife is celebrating, his daughter is celebrating. And then a few months later, the Supreme Court decides another case, this case is called Jones versus Mississippi, that really walks back the protections that the Eighth Amendment affords in these juvenile life without parole cases. And the Department of Justice, or the federal case, Department of Justice, asked the Supreme Court to what's called GVR, so grant, vacate, and remand the en banc Ninth Circuit's decision. So the Supreme Court does so. And so a few months after I've told my client, you're getting a resentencing, your life sentence is off the books, I then have to go back and say to him and his family, actually, not anymore, right? Actually, you're going to be serving a life sentence. And so I had to deliver bad news to clients before. I think it comes with the territory, but I've never had to deliver bad news after this window of real hope. And it was crushing.
Oh my gosh.
It was brutal. I mean, for me, so I can't even imagine for his family and for Mr. Briones himself. And to give you a sense of what kind of a man he is, he sort of absorbed the news. And then he said, he immediately asked when I was going to tell his wife and started thinking about who he could line up to support her in that moment, because that's the kind of person he is. So that was an example of where I felt like what the courts did was brutally unfair. And this story actually has a happy ending, because shortly thereafter, Congress passed the First Step Act. As part of the First Step Act, Congress included a mechanism for what's called compassionate release, which had previously been reserved only for folks at the Bureau of Prisons, identified as particularly deserving, which is usually folks who were very old or terminally ill. But this allowed, you know, prisoners themselves to petition a district court and say, hey, my sentence might have seemed right at the time, but subsequent events have revealed it to be wrong. And so we went before Judge Reyes, who's a district court judge in Arizona. And to his credit, despite having rejected our Montgomery argument several years earlier, I mean, he looked at the full record. He saw the ways in which it was just not serving any penological purpose to keep Mr. Briones in prison. And he granted compassionate release and did so. Mr. Briones got out just in time for his daughter's wedding.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I just got a chill. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. That is such a, I mean, what a difference you made. There's so many lessons for lawyering in that, not just the perseverance, but also just exactly how it could be sort of like something really on the ground that's going to get your client released. You've been to the highest court in the land, but that's not necessarily the end. So anyway, I love that story. And again, congratulations to you and your colleagues on that matter. This podcast is being sponsored by NextFirm. If you have wondered whether launching a law firm could be the next best step for your career, NextFirm has the experience and expertise to help. Contact NextFirm at 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com today to learn more. And follow NextFirm on LinkedIn for updates on future original jurisdiction guests. So, turning to the highest court of the land, one of the big reasons I wanted to talk to you is you've gone from 0 to 60 as a Supreme Court advocate, because before this term, you didn't have any Supreme Court arguments, and now you have 3 by the end of this term. And 3 arguments in a term, for people who don't know, that's very uncommon. There are people who work for years, even as appellate lawyers, who aspire for just 1. And the people who have 3 are the Paul Clements and Lisa Blatts of the world. So now you, Isha Anand, have joined them. So you're doing this through the Stanford Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, along with 2 other great Supreme Court advocates, Jeff Fisher and Pam Carlin. For folks who are not familiar with it, can you explain briefly, how does the clinic work?
Sure. And I should say, I don't by any stretch think I'm in the ranks of the Pauls and Lisas and Jeffs and Pams of the world, but it is a really remarkable set of opportunities, and one that I very much credit to Jeff and Pam for giving me. So Jeff and Pam have run this clinic for nearly 20 years now, and it's got a sort of storied place in the Supreme Court bar. The goal when it started, this was at a time when big Supreme Court practices didn't really exist at private sector law firms. And so there was often a real imbalance between folks on different sides of the V. And so the Stanford Supreme Court Clinic, the goal was to plug some of that imbalance and bring 2 of the best in the business. I mean, I don't know that there are many people who can stack up against Jeff and Pam, and I happen to think that they are the 2 best in the business. So to bring their kind of expertise and resources to the criminal defendant facing off against the government, the non-citizen facing off against the government, the consumer facing off against a big company, the worker facing off against the employer, because the folks in that kind of latter bucket were often folks who either could afford really experienced Supreme Court counsel, or were folks who were facing off against or were the government, which had sort of the benefit of being a repeat player before the Supreme Court. So that was the vision. And it's sort of done that in spades. So it has a remarkable track record. It's been involved in some of the biggest cases of the last 20 years. And the really remarkable thing is all of the writing, right? Every piece of paper that gets filed at the court is drafted by students. So we're lucky enough that at this point, the clinic is a full-time endeavor. So our students commit to working for us 40 or more hours a week for the entire 10-week quarter. And they write things that are filed at the United States Supreme Court. So not their first draft, not their second draft, often not their 10th or 12th draft.
Sure.
But we are lucky enough to have these brilliant, committed students and the time and space to go through the umpteen revisions it takes to get a petition or a brief in opposition or a brief on the merits into shape where it can be filed at the Supreme Court. So that's sort of how the clinic works. And we do a mix of civil and criminal work. Mm-hmm. We do a mix of cert stage and merit stage work. But the through line is really trying to put in resources where we feel like we can equalize what would otherwise look like a resource imbalance.
That's a great learning opportunity for the students because they just get to work on these amazing cases under the tutelage of three great advocates. But one thing, of course, folks will notice is the cases are argued by you or Jeff or Pam because the Supreme Court does not have a student practice rule. I mean, that would be, no offense, Stanford's an amazing law school, but to be arguing before the Supreme Court as a law student, it's a little crazy, I guess. So you argue the cases, and your first argument, which took place in October, was Murray v. UBS Securities, in which you recently got a win from a unanimous court. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And that was a case of little person versus big company. It was a whistleblower against a financial giant. How did that case come to the clinic? Or how do cases generally come to the clinic? Because it's a Supreme Court clinic. It doesn't have a funnel of trial cases it's getting.
Sure. So I think this case is pretty typical. Someone that Jeff had represented many years ago was friends with the trial attorney in this case. So Mr. Murray was the little guy, but had this really extraordinary trial team that built this really compelling record and won over a jury in the face of, you know, as you put it, this financial giant with all the resources that comes with. So they'd won this jury verdict. The Second Circuit had reversed it on appeal. It said one of the jury instructions was wrong. And Bob Herbst, the extraordinary lawyer who led the trial team, was talking with friends and acquaintances of his about next steps. And someone whom Jeff Fisher had represented many years ago said, I partner with the Stanford Supreme Court Clinic and they do extraordinary work. And if you're thinking about going to the Supreme Court, like they're the people to talk to. And so that's the way I would say probably a majority of our cases come to us is the clinic's reputation, Jeff's reputation, Pam's reputation, to a much lesser extent, my reputation, sometimes results in people who are thinking about either trying to seek Supreme Court review or honestly more and more often these days, given perceptions of how our typical client demographic will fare at the Supreme Court, trying to protect a win from Supreme Court review will often find us that way. So that's maybe two-thirds of our cases come to us in that way. And particularly, Jeff has argued some of the biggest criminal cases of our generation, right? So starting with the Confrontation Clause cases and sort of revolutionizing the way that the Supreme Court did criminal procedure, right? The thing you read about in law school, those sort of Crawford v. Washington cases. Yep. And Pam in the civil rights world, given her experience at LDF and in voting rights and arguing cases like Bostock at the Supreme Court. Particularly in those two arenas, we get a lot of cases coming to us just from folks who know of Jeff or Pam and reach out. And then there's some cases that we find because we see a petition and we think, oh gosh, that's going to be one where the Supreme Court's going to be really tempted to grant that we should reach out and see if we can help protect it from review. Or this is an issue that we are interested in and we think would be a good learning experience for our students when we see a case that kind of tees it up. So that's sort of a mix of those two.
That makes sense. And I'm curious, how was it decided that you would argue it? Because no offense, if people come to the clinic, they're probably thinking, oh, Jeff is going to argue my case or Pam's going to argue my case. And even though you had a great record in the lower courts, it would be your first argument. And so you could imagine Herbst or someone else saying, well, if it's a first time advocate, I'll be the advocate. How did it come to you to argue it?
The honest answer is through the kind of extraordinary generosity and faith of a lot of people involved in the case, right? And so that's kind of a dirty little secret about getting your first Supreme Court cases. It's not so much about you. I mean, I'd like to think that I've had a kind of compelling case to be the one to argue it, but it's about all the other people in your orbit, right? So I had Jeff and Pam vouching for me. I had Trevor Murray himself, right, who had been fired 10 years ago and has been looking for justice all that time and had this jury verdict that was on the line, saying to me, like, I think you're the one to do it. I've met you, I've talked to you, I've worked with you and the students, and I think you'll do a good job. And folks like Bob and the rest of his team, who again would have been well within their rights for Bob to say, I should get that up there. Bob's an incredibly skilled lawyer. And for them to have the humility to rightly or wrongly say, I think that someone who has Supreme Court experience would be better to stand up there. And rather than have the faith in me that as a first-time advocate, I could be that person, I think speaks volumes about the kinds of people I'm working with. But it also sort of speaks volumes about how narrow the path is to wind up at this podium, right? I don't think the thing that got me to the podium is just my skill in the abstract. It's that there were a lot of people in my orbit, starting with Jeff and Pam, extending to our co-counsel and our client, who found ways to have faith in me. And so when we think about how first-time advocates get to the podium, I think skill is a necessary prerequisite, but it's far from sufficient.
That's such an important point. And it's interesting, we're speaking right now during Women's History Month. And even if this episode is going to air later, we've had a lot of discussion, an important discussion about just the dearth of women and people of color in the courtroom at the podium at 1 First Street. So it's really great that here you are, a woman of color, and you're arguing 3 cases before the court. And I agree with you also on the generosity of your mentors, in the sense that there are a lot of very seasoned Supreme Court advocates who've written a lot of briefs and petitions, but they haven't had that many arguments because a lot of the time in front of them is a veteran advocate, and either that advocate doesn't want to give up the argument or the client won't allow it. But tell us about the morning of the argument. How did it feel standing at that podium?
I was terrified the night before. I don't think I got a wink of sleep. I didn't eat any breakfast the morning of. I was lucky enough to have, again, this kind of extraordinary team in my corner. So Trevor called me the night before to just say to me, whatever happens, I know that you're the right person to be at the podium. You know, I'm sure that his nerves were through the roof as well. So much more was on the line for him than for me. And so for him to have the extraordinary generosity to say that felt meant a lot. Bob, our co-counsel, met me in the lobby of my hotel and helped me carry my litigation bag to the court. My students had sent me these last-minute emails with final questions that I was wondering about. But when I actually got to the courtroom, it was funny. I don't necessarily think a former Supreme Court clerk has any necessary advantage over any other advocate walking into the Supreme Court, except in this one way, which is that I just have spent so much time in that courtroom. It felt really familiar. Like, I walked in and I think I can remember how overawed I felt in July of my clerkship when I first got there. But at that point, you know, it just sort of felt like coming back to an old office, right? I mean, I spent so much time sitting in those clerk chairs behind the pillar and so much time kind of cutting through the courtroom to go here or there. And so when I actually got into the courtroom, I was in some ways much calmer than I'd been for a lot of my circuit court arguments where I was in this brand new space, because I sort of, some part of my body felt like, oh, this is familiar. And then as soon as I stood up at the podium, it's like your whole brain gets absorbed with trying to pay attention to what's happening. There's no room to think about how dumb you sound or if you flubbed a question. So afterward, of course, for weeks afterward, I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my gosh, why didn't I say that? That was the answer to that really tough question. Or, oh my gosh, I said this and what I really meant was this, and I'm sure I totally confused them. So the before and after I was terrified, the actual time of the argument between the familiar setting and the fact that my poor little brain was just had to fire on all cylinders just to keep up with what was happening, I didn't have space to be nervous.
That makes total sense to me. You just go in the zone. It's almost like a great athlete or something. But that's also an interesting point about that one advantage that Supreme Court clerks do have, because they do dominate the ranks of Supreme Court advocates. And we can talk about whether that is or isn't a good thing, but it is definitely an advantage. So obviously, it worked out for you. You won 9-0. Your second argument in January was Campos Chavez v. Garland. And I predict, based on the argument, this is going to not be 9-0. But how did it feel different to you as an argument, or did it?
So in some ways, very much yes. So this was a consolidated case. There were 3 different non-citizens. Mr. Campos Chavez's name is the sort of lead name on the caption. We represented a non-citizen named Raul Mendez Colin, who had actually won at the Ninth Circuit, right? So we had filed a brief in opposition. So we were before the court, but not because we wanted to be there. And so we talked a little bit earlier about how skill isn't the only thing that kind of gets you to the podium and takes a lot of people in your orbit having faith in you. Another reason why it's clear to me that the people who end up at the podium aren't necessarily the most skilled is I like to think we did a really good job with that brief in opposition. I'd like to think that when the United States is telling the Supreme Court to take up a case, it's really hard to defeat cert. But the fact still remains, like, one of the reasons we were up there is because we lost at an earlier stage. So I think there's a lot of really terrific Supreme Court advocates who are very good at keeping cases out of the Supreme Court, and they don't end up behind the podium. But in some ways, some of the most remarkable Supreme Court advocates I know are people who've never had an argument because they're just that good at the cert stage. So it felt very different because it felt like, whereas previously my client in some ways had nothing to lose, right? The Second Circuit had already done the worst thing of saying, you've got to retry this case. And so our hope was that it got better from there. In this case, my client is someone who thought he was headed toward cancellation and being able to stay in the United States. And then there was sort of plucked out of obscurity by the United States government as the kind of person whose case teed up these issues, and suddenly found himself before the Supreme Court when he never wanted to be there. So it did feel very different in that respect. And it also felt very different to be representing three clients, only one of whom was my client. And again, you know, the way you get to the podium is a lot of people having faith in you. And so three different teams representing non-citizens, including folks who'd had decades more experience with immigration law than I did, including other Supreme Court clerks representing other folks, all got together and decided that I was going to be the one to argue it. And again, that's just a testament to, you know, the advocate who actually ends up at the podium isn't really the one who got there. It's all the people around them who got them there.
So based on your two arguments so far, is there a piece of advice or a practice pointer or tip that you could give to first-time Supreme Court advocates?
I think probably three things that I would say. The first is, when you're arguing at the Supreme Court, there's this temptation to feel like, it's so different, I have to do everything differently. And I had a little bit of that for my first argument. And it turns out that if you've been an oral advocate in other settings, the things that stood you in good stead there will stand you in good stead before the Supreme Court. There are things that are different, right? The way that the Supreme Court thinks about precedent is very different from the way that lower courts think about precedent. The fact that you know your audience ahead of time, or you know the nine people you're going to appear in front of, it's not a panel that's going to be drawn where you won't find out the week before or the morning of, matters. I mean, there's lots of differences, but those differences are fundamentally around the margin. Like, you know yourself and you know how to prepare for an argument, and those are the things you got to do. There's no reason to change it up just because you're before the court. The second thing I would say, and this isn't just about Supreme Court advocacy, it's about advocacy in general. I think when I had my first argument, part of what I was trying to do in moots and in preparing was not just to internalize the substance, but to sort of sound a little bit more like what I thought a good oral advocate had to sound like. And, you know, I frankly didn't. I up-talk. I apologize a lot. The way that I come across, I think, doesn't sound the way that I think a real Supreme Court advocate sounds, or sort of my perception of what that person sounded like. And I have this really clear memory of going into my en banc argument, and I sort of tried to scrub some of these, what I perceived as very gendered ticks, out of my language, right? I was trying to up-talk less and apologize less and do all these things. And in the actual heat of the argument, I couldn't monitor all those things. So I found myself, I apologized a bunch to the panel. And I found myself in my head just being like, oh, Isha, why did you say that? You sound like such a girl, which in my head was contrary to what it sounds like to be an advocate. And then this really remarkable thing happened where the judges started apologizing to me. I had that sort of very weird experience where Judge Graber asked me a question and she sort of said, sorry for cutting me off. Huh. And it turned into this sort of conversation that actually went really well and we wound up winning the case. And so my lesson from that is not start apologizing to judges if you're not inclined to do that naturally. But I realized that all these things that are just kind of part of the way I talk, that I was trying to scrub to sound like someone else, not only weren't going to hurt me, but actually in some circumstances might be an advantage. And so I guess the lesson from that for me is just be yourself. Talk the way you talk, right? If you are someone who talks in a way that sounds like full paragraphs coming out of your mouth, then do that. If you're someone who's funny and candid and blunt, do that. If you up-talk, do that. Because it turns out that actually the substance is what matters more. And you can't actually change the way you talk, or at least not without using a lot of mental energy that's better used for figuring out how to answer questions. So that's my second piece of advice. And the last piece of advice is just, I think it's clear from what I said so far, but I think that aiming to be a Supreme Court advocate in some ways is a little bit of a fool's errand. And I say that as someone who really greatly appreciated that opportunity. But I say that because so little of it is within your control. It depends on the people around you. It depends on the cases you take on. And I think that if you are someone who has a sort of ideological set of priors about where you want the law to go, in a lot of cases, that won't involve going through the Supreme Court. I mentioned some of the best advocates I know who are civil rights attorneys who are incredibly skilled at keeping cases out of the Supreme Court that you think the Supreme Court is going to take. And they're incredibly talented. And I think their hope is to never get a day at the podium because they are working so hard to keep things out of the court. And so the last thing I'll say is, I think you can be an extraordinary advocate, an extraordinary appellate advocate, an oral advocate without ever making it to the Supreme Court podium. And the people who make it there, there's a lot of luck of the draw. There's a lot of who you happen to be surrounded with and who you happen to be. And there's a lot of what kinds of causes and cases you care about. And so I think skill is the smallest part of that mix.
So you have one last argument this term on April 15th, so later this month in Chiaverini v. City of Napoleon. Can you just tell us briefly what that case is about or how your preparation is going? I know that Supreme Court advocates are somewhat guarded about cases that have not yet been decided, but maybe you can just give us a quick description or tell us how your prep's going.
Sure. So in this case, our client, Yasha Chiaverini, owned a jewelry store in Napoleon, Ohio. And after a series of events, basically he bought some jewelry that turned out to have been stolen, and there was some back and forth with the police department over what the right disposition was. He wound up getting arrested and charged with money laundering, which is a felony in Ohio, and then two more minor offenses, a licensing violation and a misdemeanor. And he presented evidence that the evidence underlying the money laundering charge was fabricated. And so he said the police officers got an arrest warrant based on these three charges, and one of them was totally fabricated. So let me file a Section 1983 civil rights suit alleging malicious prosecution and go before a jury. And the Sixth Circuit has this rule called the any crime rule, which says if there's probable cause for any crime, you can't maintain a malicious prosecution. So because there was probable cause for the licensing violation and the misdemeanor, these really minor offenses, it didn't matter that police fabricated evidence for the felony charge of the mix. So that's the issue before the court. So is that the right way to think about probable cause? And my preparation is beginning. As you know, David, my four-year-old son has had pneumonia the last week or 10 days. Yeah. And so we're sort of dealing with him being out of childcare while writing the reply brief in this case. But I feel really honored to get to stand up at the Supreme Court on Mr. Chiaverini's behalf and try to get some measure of justice for him.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I hope your son feels better too.
Thank you.
Let's turn to our final four questions, my standard lightning round, which is standardized for all guests. And my first question is, what do you like the least about the law? And this can either be the practice of law or law as an abstract system.
I'll say that one thing that's really been hard for me is I love working with our students who are truly extraordinary, but I hate seeing the ways in which they're just really depressed about the legal system. They have a really nihilistic view of the potential of the law and the role of courts. And, you know, I don't think I had that in law school. I think I mentioned that I was a little bit of a legal realist and I had some real qualms, but I don't think I had the same kind of existential feeling of the limits of courts and lawyers and the role of the law. I don't know how to fix that. I think there's a lot of different people who are responsible for that, but that makes me a little bit sad.
Jesse Wegman had an interesting piece in the Times about just a crisis among con law teachers in a way, because many of them, I think, are also losing their faith. But anyway, that's a huge conversation for another day.
podcast. Yeah.
My second question is, what would you be if you were not a lawyer? And maybe journalist is the obvious answer, but maybe not.
I think probably a journalist or an investigator, though I'll confess I had a brief window in college where I majored in math and thought that I might go to math grad school before I realized that was not at all the right fit for me.
Okay. So mathematician, maybe.
That's putting it generously. It's not even that it was not the right fit for me, that I was nowhere near capable enough to do that.
Okay. Well, you majored in math at Yale. I'm sure you had pretty good chops. Well, I think I read one interview of you where you said that you sat next to some prodigy who was even more prodigious than you.
I sat next to a 9-year-old in my abstract algebra class. And that was the moment when I realized, you know what? Some people maybe cut out for this a little more than I am.
Oh my gosh. I did not realize the prodigy was that young. That's insane. Yeah. My third question is, how much sleep do you get each night?
I thrive on 8 hours of sleep a night. I have to confess that since this bout of pneumonia, we're definitely not getting 8 uninterrupted hours of sleep. Anyone who has a sick 4-year-old probably knows the feeling when they're uncomfortable. They're up constantly. So now, if it's 8 hours, it's in 2-hour chunks before our kid wakes up and complains that he can't breathe or his coughing makes it too hard for him to sleep.
Wow. My last question is, any final words of wisdom, such as career advice or life advice for my listeners?
I hope I've made it clear in telling my story, but the dots only connect in retrospect. As you're living it, as you're going through one thing to the next, it didn't feel as though I was headed to this place and this job that I love, getting to teach and be affiliated with Stanford and getting to work with Jeff and Pam and argue these cases and have these amazing clients. Like, it didn't feel like every step in my career was building up to this point. It felt like a little bit haphazard, a lot of luck along the way, some good and some bad, and a lot of twists and turns. And so I guess my kind of life advice that I try to give my students is do the thing that feels best and feels most right to you in the moment. And know that when you look back, you'll see the ways in which it was all building up to the place that you were supposed to be, but it may not feel like it in every moment along the way.
I totally agree with that. And I even feel that a little bit about my own weird career trajectory too.
Yeah.
So thank you for those words of wisdom. And thank you for joining me today, Isha. And good luck on your two remaining cases.
Well, thank you so much, David. Thank you for everything you do. I'm a subscriber to Original Jurisdiction. And thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thanks so much to Isha Anand for joining me. And congratulations to her for both her three arguments this term and her big win in Murray v. UBS Securities. To my fellow SCOTUS devotees, keep an eye on Isha. She's definitely one to watch. Thanks to Nexfirm for sponsoring the Original Jurisdiction podcast. Nexfirm has helped many attorneys to leave big law and launch firms of their own. To explore this opportunity, please contact Nexfirm at 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nexfirm.com to learn more. Thanks to Tommy Herring, my sound engineer here at Original Jurisdiction, and thanks to you, my listeners and readers. To connect with me, please email me at davidlatt@substack.com or find me on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at David Latt, and on Instagram and Threads at David Benjamin Latt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Please subscribe to the Original Jurisdiction newsletter if you don't already over at davidlatt.substack.com. This podcast is free, but it's made possible by paid subscriptions to the newsletter. The next episode should appear 2 weeks from now, on or about Wednesday, April 17. Until then, may your thinking be original and your jurisdiction free of defects.